Welcome to this week's podcast of Kicking It with Kidneys with your host, Cindy Barclay. Hey, Cindy, take it away.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Kicking It with Kidneys, a forum to discuss topics important to the dialysis community and to provide a legitimate platform for those whose voices have historically been suppressed. In this episode, we will present part two of chronic kidney disease and its impact on vulnerable communities. We'll take a closer look at pre-renal screening, the five stages of renal failure, and how to prevent disease progression. Now, most folk believe that poor lifestyle practices and dietary noncompliance play a primary role in our inability to contain yet another healthcare disparity. Our panelists will continue to review the social and economic disparities that affect healthcare practices in the communities of color. And lastly, we'll share additional information on the financial burden of patients, their families, and the healthcare industry. To help explore these topics in more detail, we'll introduce our panelists, Maria Jimenez, RN and Administrative Quality Dialysis, Rita Williams, Licensed Renal Social Worker, S. Scarborough, Master's in Business Administration and Entrepreneur, and B.J. Simone, Master's in Sociology and Health Services Researcher and Trainer. What's the word on the street, B.J.?
Okay, thanks, Cindy. Our people on the street today are going to share some very personal insight. So let's pay close attention.
Word on the street with Simone.
Hey, Simone. We had it today talking to dialysis patients, and we asked them how many years they had been on dialysis, what caused their kidneys to fail, and are they on the transplant list? Here's what they had to say.
18, diabetes. Entered into my kidneys and messed them up. No. I tried three times I failed. The diabetes had went down. When I tried, they found I had a hole in my toe. That failed me. And another time I went, I had my leg had a sore abrasion that failed me. And the last time I checked, they said I had heart issues that failed me.
This is June will be 3 years. I have scleroderma, which is a autoimmune disease. No, not on the list. I also have lung disease where I need a double lung transplant. Also in heart failure. So until they get my heart stable, then I won't be able to get my lung and kidney transplant.
Those were powerful answers, and I know that it pulled at my heartstring when I first heard it. So I think what we definitely hear is the struggle that these people and many others like them experience in just trying to live with chronic kidney disease. And I think that makes it more important that anything that we can do to help them and inform other patients and the public is really needed right now.
Yes, I think I do agree with that. And to help us along in this process, Maria, can you give us a little bit more information on pre-renal and the five stages of chronic kidney disease?
Sure. As a first step, usually with diagnosing kidney disease, your doctor will discuss personal and familial history with you. Among other things, they may ask you if you've been diagnosed with high blood pressure, if you're taking any medications that may affect your kidney function, if you've noticed any changes in your urinary habits, and if you've had any family members that were diagnosed with kidney disease. With this diagnostic testing, there are certain tests and procedures like blood tests, urine tests, imaging tests, removing a sample from a kidney for testing if that's necessary. But bringing in back last week, we had discussed the GFR, that is the glomerular filtration rate, and that is done with your labs based off of your age, race, gender, things of that nature. So the GFR is a number based on your blood test for creatinine, which is a waste product in your blood.
So when they do labs, so when your physician does the labs, patients need to look at that number, that creatinine, to see what that is.
Your primary care should be looking at that as well.
Primary care physician.
Correct, with those lab works. Because when you're in the stages, there's a CKD 1 through 5. Stage 1 through 5, and that was created so that you can have a baseline of what part that you're in your disease process. So starting with CKD stage 1, it's an early stage. Some people are CKD stage 1 and stage 2 are the early stages, and a lot of patients are not symptomatic at all, but there can be signs of kidney damage if you're spilling protein in your urine. Or any physical damage to your kidneys, any trauma to your kidneys.
So that's why it's important to follow up with your doctor, you know?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, CKD stage 3 is actually broken up into two phases. There's a stage 3A and a stage 3B, which basically some of these patients still don't have any signs and symptoms. But if they do have signs and symptoms, you're considered a 3B stage. That's where you're going to have the swelling in your hands and the feet. Back pain, urinating more or less than normal.
So is that when they start seeing the nephrologist or something?
At this point, you're still with your primary care.
Okay.
But once you get to stage 3 and you become symptomatic, you should definitely visit with the nephrologist.
Okay. So what is that number?
For stage 3, the GFR needs to be between 30 and 59.
Okay. So when you say
GFR. So you go from higher numbers, your GFR starts at 90. And greater, you're okay. But once you hit that 90 mark and you start going down, that's when you're classified with the sections of CKD. So CKD stage 1 is 90 or greater. CKD stage 2 is between 60 and 89. And as you progress down to CKD 3, it's between 30 and 59. Now, CKD 4, at this point, this needs to be taken very seriously. This is the last stage before your kidneys are considered in failure, complete failure. At this point, you still do have increased swelling, increased back pain, urination issues, blood pressures that are, you know, all out of range. But at this point with CKD4, you should have already been with a nephrologist, actually have been partnered with a dietitian to help you with dietary changes as well. And at this point, you should be preparing for stage 5, which is kidney failure.
Oh, wow.
Preparing for the potential for dialysis or the potential for renal transplantation at that time.
So the stages, Maria, they're individualized as well as a patient? They don't go, I mean, what's the time? Is it a time span between stages?
Well, it depends on what you do to... when you're in the early stages, what you're doing, what you're being proactive with doing to stop the stages from progressing.
The patients need to be in there and taking care of their health and following directions from
controlling the blood sugar. Even if it's bad at this point, with more control, you can slow or potentially stop your kidney disease process at that time. Blood sugars, making sure your blood pressure is under control, not smoking, eating healthier. Being active at least 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and maintaining a healthy weight as well.
Okay.
But by the time you reach CKD 5, stage 5, your GFR is less than 15, which means it's time to start.
So you're saying out of 100. So let's just use an analogy. So I've got 100%. So you're saying that right now I'm using 100% of my kidneys, and when they diagnose me in stage 5, then I'm at 15%.
Correct.
That, oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. That's alarming.
You're feeling terrible. Your blood is not being cleaned. You're swollen. You've gained tons of not body weight, but literal fluid weight. You know, when you touch on your skin and you hold, you mash it down on your feet or your ankles, and you still see your fingerprint there. it causes you to retain a lot of fluid because your kidneys are not functioning.
So stage five and end-stage renal disease, are you, the terminology is used interchangeably?
Correct. ESRD is at stage five. End-stage renal disease means you're on dialysis.
Okay. Well, is it possible for me to be in stage five and be cured?
There's something that's called acute renal failure.
Okay.
To where you may have to be in stage five, start dialysis, but we're monitoring your functions, monitoring your labs, monitoring your fluid intake and all that good stuff to see if there's a potential for recovery. Right. And sometimes there are.
What is the probability? Is it high or low or like next to none?
It depends on the reason why you started dialysis.
Okay.
There's trauma where the kidneys are just shot based off of medications that they gave you in the hospital at that time. And there's no chance for renal recovery. But a lot of times if you've got the diabetes and the hypertension, slowing that will slow the process or reverse the process. It could.
If you see your doctor and do what you're supposed to
compliance
do.
Compliance is the key.
Rita, so we've talked a lot about African Americans,
right?
You know, since they're the primary shareholders in all of this.
Right. Okay? We're right behind you guys. We're buying up community.
Okay. Let's talk about your
sure,
Latinos.
Definitely. And as we know, the Latino community is one of the largest minority groups in the United States. They, you know, it's a high burden of chronic kidney disease. I mean, we have a lot of sugar diabetes. We have a lot of high blood pressure right behind every other minority well.
Yes.
We're really making strides, I guess. We're catching up. We're catching up. But there is a difference for minority treatments. I was reading some of the research, and research has shown that those with medical insurance, you know, they may have medical insurance. There's a delay in services as well. Like Maria was
Did you know that only 10% of the patient population that's on dialysis have an actual health insurance?
That's right. That's right. A commercial insurance.
Commercial insurance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Once they 10%. Get into dialysis, then we can start doing those applications and assisting them to get Medicare.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is true. And that's what, you know, 25% of Latinos have regular a health care provider. Like Maria was saying, that PCPs, a lot of the Latino community does not go to their PCP to begin with for basic healthcare.
Yeah.
And then they start noticing, like you said, the swelling and all that kind of stuff. And they're like, what's going on? You know, they haven't been taking care of their diabetes. They haven't been taking care of their, you know, high blood pressure.
Well, let's talk about resources though.
Okay. Well, and some of that is that some people have insurance, like you said, 10%. A lot of them are underinsured though. Even if they do have that insurance, they're underinsured.
By that you mean?
Well, it's not enough. Some of it covers some part of renal, and some of what it is, a lot of our patients can't afford the co-pays that go along with this insurance. You know, to see a nephrologist, that's a specialty. It's maybe a higher co-pay. It may be $50 instead of the $25 or the $10 or whatever that, you know, specialties are always higher co-pays. So, you know, if you're choosing between going to see a specialist and seeing your regular doctor, you may want your PCP to care for that. We know that's not a good idea. Idea is to go on to that nephrologist and start following all of that. A lot of things also that we found was that like I said, they don't have the money for those medical tests Maria was talking about. The treatments, maybe there is something they could do, you know, different medications and stuff they can be on to be with the high blood pressure and the sugar diabetes to bring those down so we don't progress through the stages as fast. I mean, or stop it. Right. You said they could stop it, right?
The generational curses again.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Generational curses.
Yeah. So it's like, well, my mother had it. I'm going to have it. Why am I taking all these pills or going to see all these specialists? But, you know, of course, some of the social factors are the poverty, the economic instability, the limited to health insurance, communication barriers.
Yes, I mean,
even with your primary care doctors, a lot of people that only speak Spanish, the primary care doctors don't speak Spanish. And once again, we have to use the translators and sometimes things get lost.
So BJ, tell me, can you, are you aware of any healthcare initiatives in the communities that would improve the outcome of this disease and disease awareness?
Well, yes. You know, we touched on so many things in our last episode, but I wanted to start by looking at national healthcare initiatives. And I got this idea from something that Sarita said. So it was very interesting to find that the Office of Minority Health, which is under the Department of Health and Human Services, actually has the prevention of kidney disease listed as one of their specific focus areas for the fiscal year 2020-2021. Now, I don't know how this is going to translate into real-world application, but it's good to know that at least it's on a national agenda. And one of the other things that they included as one of their priorities was cultural competence among healthcare providers nationwide. And that was something that Maria and Rita alluded to last time when they were talking about the challenges of constantly talking and educating patients, and it doesn't seem to be
working.
Making a point with them. They don't seem to get it. You know, they're not connecting the dots. So I was thinking that maybe there is a better way to get the message out in communities of color. And this is something that I would like to just really explore with the group in a little bit more detail.
Okay. And I also read some of that of research as well. And it did talk about how a big part that the PCP doctor does play in that, encouraging the minority community to get the pre-screenings and stuff like that. And also that building that relationship, you know, because some of the signs are, you know, lower back pain can mimic other things, but, you know, to start thinking and bringing forefront that kidney care is very prominent in minorities.
Yes, yes, yeah. It is. Yes,
so sir. Being culturally competent about our ailments as well.
Well, Maria, you've worked with a lot of these patients, and basically what I've seen as I've worked with them as well is that sometimes they are very complacent. Do you see a lot of that?
Oh, a lot.
How are we going to change one's thought processes? How are we going to get you rejuvenated and recharged to take care of yourself and to understand that the benefits and the organizations that are around now that are attempting to help you may not be here in the future?
Well, it definitely is a challenge because you still have patients that are, you know, CKD stage 5 on dialysis and they're still not compliant. So it's just going to take education that's ongoing. We just continue to, you know, to press forward, and you can't hit them all, but we can hit most. We can attempt to hit most as far as education and slowing this process. But it is a lot of this is just the way things have been, being complacent. Like Rita said, my grandmother had this, and this is now it's just my time,
right,
when it doesn't have to be.
Right.
And I think, like Maria is saying, I think we have to individualize that. And we have that opportunity sometimes to do that. I mean, yeah, we're talking about phosphorus overall, but we're talking about you, Mr. Jones.
Yes.
This is what is affecting you. This is what it's doing to your body.
And your siblings.
And your siblings.
And your children.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the company Quality Dialysis is a little bit different.
Right.
You know, than your most of your in-centers. Where they're just like ran it like cattle. By the time you put a patient
you haven't had enough time. Maria. I mean, there is no individuality sometimes.
You haven't had enough time to do as much education and reach as much. But, you know, with individualized home programs, like with Quality Dialysis, you have that one-on-one time where you can make a difference with those patients.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I was thinking about when I was working with Native American communities, while we talk about the breakdown of the family unit in many minority groups,
right,
I think there is still a traditional practice of giving respect and deference to elders.
Very true.
So I just want to share an example of what we did. There was a family, and there was issues within the family dynamic of there being one caregiver who was in conflict with the other family members.
Okay.
She was providing the care, but because, you know, there was this sort of infighting, then the patient wasn't being compliant with the things that they needed to do. They were continuing to drink and some other things that, that was causing all kind of crisis. What we did is we looked at the matriarch of that family.
That's right.
And we said, let's talk to the matriarch, because getting the family to listen to healthcare providers and someone from the outside just isn't going to be effective enough. And we talked to her, which is not unlike what you guys are saying, you know, really helping them understand what the impact this is to the rest of the family. So we talked to her, and she actually talked to the family, and they gave her the deference, and we were able to at least get some progress in that family. So
that's a great
maybe
idea.
That is, yeah, something that we need to think of. The issue that I also find with that is, when I work with the VA, is there's money. There always comes down to money, and Maria was saying, you don't always have the time. Well, time is money.
Yes.
And so then the question is, how do you allot that time for education, particularly if it's not directly to the family? How does that time get compensated?
Well,
so those are things that you have to think about, too.
That's true. And education, I mean, dialysis units, the average dialysis unit, not our home program, but the average dialysis unit, I mean, those nurses are very busy,
Mm-hmm.
So it's supply and demand. So you finish with one shift, it's another shift. So there may be some deficits there. I think that they are. ESRD, end-stage renal disease, is a life-threatening disease, but it has significant economic sustainability, of which minorities have very little economic presence. Now, what I mean by that is that there is not enough of us to control, in the administrative role in our businesses. There are very few of us in the position to make major decisions regarding the funds that are used that are associated with this disease. So, Sarita, let's bring you in.
Okay. Well, I think all of you guys have been talking about money. I've heard co-pays, I've heard insurance, a number of different things that you guys have said around the table today all come back to the money. And that's why I always say it always starts with the money or stops with the money.
Right.
I did a little research this weekend because I wanted to really break some things down. And so the first question I asked was, how many dialysis centers are in the United States?
7,500 or so?
7,566.
Okay.
Wow.
Of that, your top two organizations, they represent 72% of the business.
Mm-hmm.
If we broke that down, you would be talking about 5,455 freestanding facilities.
Mm.
Now let's get to the money.
Okay.
Just these two organizations for FY 2020 grossed $31,959,000,000 for 1 year.
Right. Well, they wouldn't be able to gross that, Sarita. Let me just play the devil's advocate, okay? They wouldn't be able to gross that if we did better within our communities, okay? You know, I mean, the businesses.
But since we're not, let's pick up the coins where we can get them.
That's right. And that actually also represents.
No, you didn't come to me, Maria.
Facts.
That represented a 5.6 increase in revenue from 2019. Now,
Rita, should we keep her or put her off the show? Because she doesn't.
No, we're going to keep her.
Okay, she's exposing people out.
She's checking the Cindy.
Okay, checking.
No.
We're talking about this $31 billion caring for 554,038 people on an annual basis nationwide, and that does not include your transplantations.
Okay. So you're talking about that $90,000 a year that most people don't even make.
That's correct.
Okay. That most people don't even make $90,000 a year that we're spending, that patients may not be getting the best information. They may not be understanding what they need to do with their families. They may not be able to, you know.
If Medicare is paying for it, it's not their money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but it is their money.
It might be yours, but it may not be theirs.
Well, I like to think that they, at some point in time in their lifespan, paid into the Medicare system.
Well.
So are you saying that was then and this is now?
Yes.
Okay, but go on. Continue.
Now, the other thing I want to point out is when you talk about minorities having a bigger share, I didn't do a total sum, but
Just a voice. You know, I'm just talking about a little seat at the table.
Well, I'm talking about the money.
Okay.
I'd like a piece of the pie too.
Mm-hmm. But and ice cream.
But what we find if we use what we call supply chain management.
Okay.
And we talk about who is all involved in the process of dialysis from start to finish. Mm-hmm. Now, I did a partial listing, and I came up with about 20 different individuals. Mm-hmm. You're talking about insurance companies, mm-hmm. general practitioners, nephrologists, billers, coders, collection mm-hmm. agencies, marketing and advertising. At the higher level, at the federal level, you're talking about lobbyists.
Mm-hmm. I want dialysis mm-hmm. patients to really listen to that. Because these yeah. are all the people that are recipients of funds.
Right.
Okay. And they probably don't even know that. But hit that again for me.
Well, I'm just naming a few. Your lobbyists, your lawyers, your technology, your IT people that put the software and the systems together that are required by CMS to be able to do the reporting. Mm-hmm. You're talking about your transportation, your accountants, your distributors. Oh, and let's not forget your pharmaceuticals, your manufacturing of the machines. Mm-hmm. And so now we go back to your question, where is it that people of color, and I'm not saying that mm-hmm. all people of color do not have skills, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. when we look at it and we go back to the educational model, and I'll leave that for BJ's plate over there, mm-hmm. but we don't have those skill sets. That's why there's such an emphasis on teaching children the STEM, the science, technology, math now, and it's the E represents something. But this is why we are not at the table and not why we are not getting a piece of the pie.
But what I hear also, Sarita, is that, you know, after you really talk about all the people that are profiting from kidney disease, that it's a business.
It is a business.
Even the nephrologists and, have become businessmen. Instead of doing what's best interest for the patient based off of modalities, they're educating mm-hmm. them on modalities that's going to put money in their pocket.
Well, right. So you say, Maria. I mean, Rita, what are you supposed to do? Now, that's what Maria says. Okay, but what do you say? Aren't you supposed to give them a list, Rita?
Yes.
You're supposed to give them a list.
We always give them choices, but when they're all kind of thinking the same thing. Mm. Well, I do give choices. Always, our patients always have a choice.
I'm going to have to agree with Maria, and this is why. When we look at dialysis, we don't look at it as a system. Mm-hmm. No. Dialysis is mm-hmm. a system, just like the political system, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, the criminal mm-hmm. justice system. They're all systems. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing wrong with the dialysis system. Mm-hmm. The goal is to offer at least a base level of care
right.
set by the federal government and the networks as to what the standards are.
Right.
And then to monetize the patients. And by that, I mean monetizing, you're making money off of them. There has to be some level of profit.
Yeah, but Sarita, you know what? I have seen many physicians try to get patients involved in their care in the form of patient care conferences. They're not available for that. You know,
well, Cindy, you know our patients have to work. I mean, they can't always be ready for those patient conferences. Or, I mean, it's not always possible. We want this care to be patient-center-based.
Yes.
And we do, because we all want to have a part in their care and stuff. And sometimes the patient's just not available because, you know, I have to work to keep that insurance up.
So what you're saying is that the doctor has to make allowances for his time.
That's right.
Or the patient mm-hmm. has to
look. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So that's a tough decision.
Yeah.
That's a tough decision.
Well, you know, also, I think there's one of, you know, we mentioned this in an earlier episode when we talk about, unfortunately, racist attitudes. Sometimes people go into a care provider and they look at them and they just automatically assume there's no point in me spending any time telling you what to do because you're not going to do it. And that was something that Maria said in our last episode. She said, you know, it's not always about education because she has people who don't, you know, she has patients who aren't highly educated, but she said they see the light and they tend to be more compliant. And you have other people who, you know, don't necessarily fit that criteria and they don't. But it's the experience. And I think since we are talking about people in communities of color, This is something that they face. They are herded in. There is this attitude that, you know, why should I spend time? You're not going to do it anyway. And they don't. I've been with doctors and they spend less than 5 minutes with me. They come in.
But that's what you allow your doctor to do.
Yeah.
Well, granted. But well, Maria, you
didn't,
how many
I remember that situation. You didn't allow your doctor to do that. I remember.
Well, no, I don't. But I'm saying the fact is so many people do, because in my working with patients, right, when I worked at the VA, I saw how there is this attitude that medical professionals are God, particularly doctors. Right. They're gods,
and
you don't question them.
Yeah,
and you don't question them. Even if they're telling you something that flies in the face of, that doesn't seem right. Mm-hmm. You may not know what's wrong with it, but it doesn't seem right. You know, maybe tell me what else I can do. And so, you know, I think we can't ignore that as being something that people of color face their detriment.
I think the flip side of that, though, too, is that the population that we're talking about in many cases.
Yes.
They don't know what questions to ask a doctor.
Now. Right.
I call a friend of mine who happens to be a nurse, and I'll say, well, what does this mean?
Right.
You know, the doctor has a way of explaining things that are not in lay terms.
Vacuum, like in the vacuum.
People. Yeah. And so over
they
a period of time, they're going to get desensitized and just be like, okay, let me let them say what they're going to say, and then I'm going to go home and still do what I'm doing, because I didn't understand what he or she said to begin with.
You're looking for someone to translate what the doctor said.
Yes. Yeah,
you're still working out with a nurse saying, and did the doctor
say
this?
A lot of the people in the doctor's offices are not nurses.
That's right. You know, you're right.
Yeah, so
you're
they don't have the knowledge.
That's right.
To kind of, you know. So is it my responsibility for my lack of knowledge? Is that what you're saying, Sarita?
My being the patient?
Yes.
To a certain extent, yes. Because we you know, and I don't want to just really get down to the
bottom. But if I don't know what to ask, then why isn't there some type of comprehensive course?
I think people find out what they want to find out.
Well, I want to know everything about my kidneys.
Well, sometimes at these doctor's offices, it's like the blind leading the blind, Cindy.
And sometimes you don't even see a doctor. You may go two or three appointments and see
the practitioner
or someone else. And then the doctor comes in once a month and says something to you and is out the door and writes on his chart, sends it over to the biller and the coder and says, I visited with Ms. Scarborough today.
But there's access to information. Again, we are in the age of technology.
That's true.
And whether it's good information or bad information, the information is there. What are we doing with it?
Well, I think you missed the first episode. If you ever want to keep a secret, put it in a book.
But what about the population of people that are not technologically savvy? Okay. I mean, my generation, I've had to come up to speed. Okay. But there are a lot of people in my generation, computers. You know, I mean, they sit, they'll watch television, but they're not very versed on the language. They don't know a lot about computers, Maria. You're young, you're energetic, you know. You were brought up on computers, were you not?
Yes, I was.
Okay. So what do I do with my generation? How do I get them? I think it is back to the healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
It's back to us. We need
to
assess.
It's back to the community
centers. Yes. And we need to assess their knowledge when we first see these patients to know that. I mean, as an experienced nurse, I know when somebody's I can look at the nonverbal communication and know when somebody is getting it and when they're not, and not just push them aside and say, I trained them and that was it. You know, we've got to do better, I think.
Well, I think we have to hold people accountable. If it's our PCPs, then we need to hold our PCPs accountable. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that is who my contact person is, because, you know, we're working with insurance and we're working with money, if my PCP is supposed to manage my care, then why doesn't he have all this education available to me?
Well, and I think
one of the initiatives that is being bantered about is to establish more community health representatives.
Yes,
right.
And particularly in minority communities, I think that that's going to be very useful.
Well, I heard about that community those initiatives. Mm-hmm. Like I think CVS is one of the places to where. they're saying they're getting involved more in community outreach. Mm-hmm. However, how many CVSs or Walgreens or any of those places are in our communities? So in other words, we're reaching out to you.
Because we are on medications. They're mm-hmm. there.
Right.
We're on medications. They're making money. They're in the hood.
They're in the hood.
In our neighborhood.
Okay, hood. Well, I'm going down to the hood next week and check that out.
They're there.
Okay, they're there.
Stop all by right. and wave at me.
Oh, you're in the hood too?
I'm in the
okay,
hood too.
All right. All right.
You know, the only thing I wanted to add to that, though, is that mm-hmm. What I understand about dialysis is that part of the glue that's missing is the family involvement. Mm-hmm. When you talk mm-hmm. about the seniors, now let's just use, for example, if I had a grandparent that was on dialysis, he or she may not be able to use the technology. But you would think somewhere between me and my siblings or my parents, there would be some kind of way to support that. I mean, when a person gets to be a certain age, they don't take themselves to the doctor.
They rely on others.
They right. rely on others. And it's usually a family person.
Right.
So I often found myself going to the doctor with a family member.
Right.
And then when we got home, I'd have to explain, well, you're supposed to take this so many times a day. These are the consequences. If you take this incorrect, they just don't know. So when we're dealing with seniors, we're dealing with a special group of people that are unlike the ones 65 and above.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think mm-hmm. that's where you have to yeah. get more family
and we've
involvement.
We've talked about the family unit or the family network mm-hmm. or whatever, but we see it breaking down.
Yes.
I mean,
grandmother's 35 years old.
Yeah.
I met a grandmother the other day, 35 years old. Okay. What is she going to be able to?
She was busy.
What did she say? What did she going to be able to do? What?
Scarborough said she was busy. Isn't that horrible? Okay.
So you said she's 35
year old grandmother.
Yeah. Yeah. They're getting younger and younger. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a lot of deficits. And our job is to educate our renal patients, but there are so many problems within our community, Sarita, as you know. And how do you make money again? Poor folks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most poor folks are who?
People of color.
People of color.
But it doesn't say that the system is not working.
Okay.
That actually is the whole point.
Okay.
The system is designed to make money off of people. Mm-hmm. And that's where we talk about the monetization.
Correct.
In this particular mm-hmm. example, it just happens to be people who are poor and people who are of color.
Right. Mm.
But as you said, it is a business. And maybe part of the mission in helping our communities is helping people understand that just because the business exists doesn't mean you have to be a willing patron of it.
That's right.
Well, we have to kind of wrap the show up. Okay. So let's get some final thoughts. We're going to start with Rita.
Okay. So I think be a voice for yourself. We need to empower mm-hmm. our communities to be a voice for themselves. Speak out. If something's not right, make the change.
All right. Maria.
All right. I just think an important thought or thing to remember is that with chronic kidney disease, your kidneys do not usually fail all at once. It's mm-hmm. a disease process that is very slow. And often over a period of years. So that's good news about the disease process. And you can catch it early with medications as well, lifestyle changes, and helping slow its progression will keep you feeling your best as long as possible. So stop the bleeding.
Mm. I like that.
DJ.
Well, I think my final thought for today would be to find ways to promote that education. We talk about communication. I think working with finding more effective ways to communicate in the in communities of color, that we can't say one size fits all.
That's
there are
mean.
Specific things that we really need to target for minority groups that don't necessarily translate to other groups.
Well said. Sarita, you're smiling.
Well, of course, I'm going to always take a different approach, but I'd like to see minorities become more involved in the process of the technology side mm-hmm. or the business side of mm-hmm. dialysis. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. we have to create ways to train individuals. I mean, it can be as simple as a lab technician. or an LVN. Doesn't, but that's the way we start making money from the system. And sometimes when we have people that are working with us that look like us, then we may be a little more inclined to listen to the things that the nurses and the social workers are saying. But, you know, if it's just somebody that can't relate, you know, when, when I'm just out and about in a neighborhood, you know, I may not be at the same level as the other person, but we share the same experiences and backgrounds. And I think that makes a big difference.
But I think corporate America has got a handle on what you just said, because in most of these dialysis facilities, they're black, it's black representation and Latino. The nurses are black, okay? The social workers, dietitian.
Of, dialysis units.
Yes, there are lots of them. Okay.
But in those units, they're using technicians more so than RNs.
Right.
Which means they're at the lower portion of the pay scale.
Back to capitalism. Back to capitalism.
That's right.
We need more nurses, just, and we need more nurses positioned in those units to teach. You see what I'm trying to say? But nobody wants to spend money because that's revenue that's pulling out of one's pocket.
That's correct.
And I think that's what we need to do. I like that analogy. Well, let me leave a final thought with you. No one needs to spend time making excuses for our past. We need to participate in the decision-making to guarantee our future. Well, that's it. You guys want to say bye or whatever?
Bye, guys.
Okay.
Bye.
All right.
See you next time.
Okay. So join us next week where we'll be talking about the economic impact of salt. Okay, we hope you've enjoyed our show, and we look forward to you joining us next week on another segment of Kicking It with Kidneys.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Kicking It with Kidneys with your host, Cindy Barclay. See you next week.
The views expressed on this podcast are educational and opinion-based. These are not medical doctors.